Consequence Podcast Network.
This week, on The Sidetrack, we'll be joined by television writer and executive producer Moises Zamora, whose new Netflix series Selena premieres December 4th on the global streaming behemoth platform of the universe. We'll talk breaking into television, screenwriting, and the 2001 film he's lending his commentary for, the Alejandro Amenábar film, The Others. That's this week on The Sidetrack. Welcome back to yet another edition of The Sidetrack. It's me, your host, Paul Davidson, and I was laughing here to myself because if I'm not amusing myself, what is the purpose of this whole thing? I always sound so surprised when I say The Sidetrack in the opening. That's this week on The Sidetrack. On The Sidetrack. I'm going to string together an entire episode of me saying those three words with all different emotions. Anger. The Sidetrack. Surprise. The Sidetrack? Stunned. The Sidetrack. It's something I'll do for my own entertainment, but not for yours. Your entertainment lies within the episode that is about to unfold before you. But what of this episode? What will be contained within the Pandora's box of this week's edition of The Sidetrack? That in a moment, but first, some house cleaning. House cleaning sounds so pedestrian, but I did want to just give a call out. This is our first official episode under the banner of Consequence Podcast Network. You probably heard it at the opening, the network ID with some really wonderful sounds. In any case, this is the first week, the official first week that we're a part of the Consequence Podcast Network. We are proud. We are flying our Consequence Podcast Network flag high today from atop the Sidetrack facility in downtown Los Angeles. Sounds very official. As we enter into the month of December, this will be the end of our first season. And if you're curious how we've figured that whole thing out, every 4 months will be a new season of the Sidetrack. So we'll kick back into our second season starting in January. But there's still a handful of great episodes this month, some really exciting stuff coming, continuing our trend of bringing you the most fascinating individuals in Hollywood and the most fascinating commentaries available today. I'll continue to remind all of you out there, but three R's of podcast success: rate, review, and retweet. If you like the show, go over to iTunes Podcast, look us up, leave a review, rate the show. And if you follow us on social media, we're Sidetrack Cast on Twitter and The Sidetrack Cast on Instagram. Follow and, be a part of the conversation. Great segue. This week, as mentioned in the opening, Moises Zamora, a writer, producer, and, man about town. He's here this week to talk to us not only about how he became a writer and a producer in the television industry, but more specifically, the release of his new series on Netflix, which premieres on December 4th, Selena. You may, of course, remember there was a movie, Selena, in 1997, was it? No. It was 1997 with Jennifer Lopez. It was the movie that broke her out of the background dancer career that she had established for herself on In Living Color, written and directed by Gregory Nava. But now we have a series. So the question that always enters my mind is, why? Why now? How does it differentiate itself from the movie? We're going to ask those questions. But in addition, we'll talk a bit about the 2001 film, The Others, written, directed, and scored by Alejandro Amenábar, starring Nicole Kidman, a film that went on to generate $209 million at the box office on a paltry budget of $17 million. As I mentioned on the commentary episode, in the opening. $17 million for a genre film, yes, with Nicole Kidman, makes sense. These days, in the Blumhouse model, $17 million is way too much for a genre film. But this one, major success. And that is the film that Moises has provided a feature-length audio commentary for. And it's a great watch, and we'll talk about that as well. So, all of that house cleaning aside, sit back and enjoy our conversation with Moises Zamora here on The Sidetrack. So here we are with Moises Zamora. How are you, Moises?
Well, I'm doing well. Thank you, Paul, for having me.
So you are where during this year of us being confined to our homes? Are you located? Are you in the West Coast, LA?
I am. I'm in Los Angeles. And you know what? I've been sort of working from home since December of last year, just finishing some of the episodes for some rewrites for Celina the series. So it was okay for me to make the transition into staying even more at home. But, unfortunately, the socializing gets in the way.
I ask this question of everybody going through this time period, especially people that need to be creative. You know, the side of producing is one thing. Producing is very much it's a tactical bit of work. So it doesn't require that part of our brain that also inhabits the part of our brain that has anxiety and is thinking about where's the world going. How for you in the last 6 to 10 months has that impacted your ability to be creative?
I'm not sure how the rest of the creative screenwriting community feels, but for me, it was a positive experience. I actually generated a lot of work. And I think it has to do with how I started writing, really. And for me, it was a cathartic process. It was just trying to answer questions that I couldn't answer through religion or politics or just even my whole identity, dealing with your sort of self-awareness and having this time, where a lot of loved ones are perhaps dying and this sort of moment of social reckoning, it allowed me to go a little bit inward and just sort of, try to find creatively an answer to how are we enduring this process? How as a society, as a human race, we're gonna cope with this? And it, just be aware that this is a very pivotal moment in our times, and usually when these kind of moments happen, really good art comes out of it.
And when you're being so prolific during this time frame, how do you handle the situation of, okay, I'm writing something, I want to tell a story. Are you telling a story in a world that exists now with the pandemic? Are you telling a story assuming that the world goes back to normal at some point? I know that some creative folks have had issues trying to wrap their head around what story are you writing? Are you writing a story for a post-pandemic world? How do you think about that?
I think it has been a sort of combination of a lot of things. I was particularly working on a script that while it took place post-pandemic or as a sort of a consequence of the pandemic and losing, family members to the disease, it took on sort of a more of a magic realism type of a genre that I had explored before in my writing, but it felt that I needed sort of this sort of magical new space in order to, just basically cope with loss and grief. Yeah. What we're all sort of kind of going through collectively. So, but at the same time, I also was writing a couple of other things that had nothing to do with pandemic, that were more escapisms different worlds. And but I think that the fact that I've entered into genre, even sci-fi, in this sort of during this time, I think it was natural for a lot of people to sort of,
Well, where I want to start, and clearly we're going to talk about Selena, but it's interesting if someone were to look at your IMDb as an example. Like I always like to use this metaphor of like the iceberg. Like you see the tip of the iceberg coming out of the water, and that's what most people know. They know the iceberg, the tip of the iceberg for you, which is, wow, over the last 4 years, this string of writing and producing on some really great shows, from American Crime to Star to Selena, which comes out on the 4th of December. But it's what exists below the water that kind of is the work to get you to the point where finally you're this overnight, you know, success, right? And for you, I guess the question that I wanted to start with is, you know, you grow up in Mexico, you move to the States when you're 11, go to college back east. You're not, at least from what I can tell, you're not studying film or screenwriting. There must come a point, and I'm trying to understand what's that milestone moment for you, and when did it happen, where you said, wow, I'm going down this path, but really my passion is X.
I actually do have a specific moment because I marked it. I was a little dramatic about it.
No, it's good.
I came into Brown University actually as a biology major, and then I switched to international relations, mostly because I grew up with my dad. He was a doctor in Mexico, he's a physician here in the United States. And so I was sort of always, you know, expected to sort of follow that trajectory of, you know, becoming a doctor or study medicine. But it was very quickly, you know, as soon as I got to Brown, that the thing that I was more passionate about is that there was no sort of general requirements,
right,
of classes. So it was, you could just take anything. So I took a playwriting class. And I think that really changed my perspective on what writing could be. And then continued to take playwriting classes, and then I created a writing workshop. And then towards the end of Brown, I think it was my junior year, I started to really engage with writing and expressing myself. And I found myself, you know, with a 20-year-old going through emotions.
Hey, it's okay.
Through just writing down some journal entries, and my English, so my writing would change from, without me knowing, from English to Spanish.
Right.
And for some reason, even though I had a sixth grade education in Spanish, it just felt like it was just more emotional, just a little bit more authentic. I don't know. Maybe I was just, you know, still kind of wasn't 100% confident in my creative writing in English. And so at that point, I decided that I would write in Spanish. So I kept taught myself how to write at a literary level in Spanish. And towards the end, I think it was senior year, and this is the moment that I'm sort of, you know, when I declared that I was going to be a writer, it was spring weekend at Brown University, lots of concerts right before finals. I was slightly intoxicated. And I basically was like, just gathered my friends around, and well, they were also slightly intoxicated, and just basically declare out loud that I was going to be a writer, that was going to be my life purpose and my commitment. And call me stubborn, I kind of never really diverged from that goal. And so every kind of job that I've taken since then has always been to sustain and help me achieve that goal. So as soon as I graduated from Brown University, I moved to Paris to write a great Mexican novel in Spanish, because, like, you know, all important authors that you have to go to Paris.
Well, I mean, that and how long were you in Paris for?
I was there for 6 months, and I ended up writing most of the Spanish language novel that eventually end up winning second place in a literary contest in Madrid in Spain, and then first place in Mexico.
And how are your parents, who wanted you to be a doctor, reacting to your proclamation that you are going to be a writer?
I'm utterly confused. I mean, they just didn't understand it, you know, because we, you know, they're the people that sacrificed a lot, and, you know, they've always supported my endeavors, especially because, you know, I've always been a nerd and always gotten good grades. I've always sort of have come through with that. But it just, you know, they worried about me, right?
Sure.
Because, you know, from time to time, I had to ask him for rent money. So they were always questioning, like, well, this is not really working out. Is it this hobby of yours? And always consider it a hobby because, right. you know, you don't get a degree. You don't, it's not a sort of like a clear path.
Right. Are they reading the stuff you're writing? Are they, the joke is always like, my parents love my writing. how did they fit into that, the feedback loop?
You know what? I to this day, I don't know if they read my book or not.
Yeah.
Because I think it's a really difficult sort of conversation to have. I think it scares them.
Yeah.
My dad is an avid reader. He goes to tons of books. He likes his, you know, the middle-aged thrillers.
Sure.
I mean, middle. and I'm not quite sure if he's read it, you know, because it's very French.
Yes.
It's inspired by my experience there. So there's a, you know, sexuality there and poetry and drugs and,
right.
you know, these things that probably are like, is this really my son?
Right.
So I never really actually had a conversation about if they read it or not. They experienced, you know, the book presentations, the articles, you know, they've held that book in their hands. And so they know that there's something tangible,
right.
that it, you know, that was able to sort of achieve in this endeavor that is writing.
And so we've distilled down to the moment for you when you said, I'm going to be a writer. What do you think the moment was for them, your parents, who we endlessly want to make our parents proud no matter how old we are? The moment where they said, they looked at you or reacted to something, whether it be the book or the first TV show writing gig, where they said, okay, you're a writer.
I think there were two moments and for separate reasons. The first one, I think it was when I received the literary award for the book.
Yeah.
And there was a ceremony, and they, you know, my friends and my family, they came and they saw academics, you know, give presentations about it, and, you know, when they were presenting. So there was, I think that was a very key moment of like, okay, we get it, you're a writer.
Yeah.
But they didn't believe that it would be a sustainable profession until much later.
Yes.
And I think that came about when American Crime, when I got my first TV writing job on American Crime, when
yeah.
they saw the name on screen and I wasn't asking for rent money. Even though at the time I was already working for an advertising agency, and I didn't need their money, but it felt that like, okay, they're paying you for it. It's available, you know, it came out on ABC. You're a writer, you made it, you know, and that, I think that since then they have not been embarrassed to say that I'm a writer to people they know.
And so for you, the American Crime moment was, you know, a justification of, okay, you're officially, you know, you're writing for television. There's your name on screen. Up to that point, from breaking into the TV space, what was the most challenging aspect of that for you? Was it getting people to read you? Was it getting a rep? Was it pitching yourself in the room, being a salesman for yourself? For folks who are struggling to cross that milestone, that part in the road, what's your best advice? And I think, and by the way, I'd say it's probably two questions, because I think there's a general question of just like, what does it take?
Yeah, I mean, I think the idea here is that I never stopped writing. I never stopped working on my craft. Yeah, sure, it was, you know, novels and plays at first, but it was, like I said, it was a life commitment, a sort of a purpose. And so I never stopped working on it. I think the challenge for me was coming back, because I spent a whole year in Mexico doing the book tour, and then coming back and realizing that while it was, you know, it was successful and it got an award, like I was still sort of struggling financially. So it was a time when I did heed my parents' call, you know, advice of like, get a job that can sustain your creative endeavors.
Right.
And so that's why I went into advertising and to Hispanic agencies to keep, you know, working. So this bilingual sort of space. And but I knew that while I was working, that I needed to continue with that path already, make that my profession. And, you know, being in Los Angeles is so wonderful because there's so many creative people and so many people with the same goal and dreams, and you feel like you're not alone. And, you know, writing novels and trying to be an author, it's a very lonely place and lonely process. So I really was attracted to that. And then I had a friend from USC who was, you know, working on his director thesis and short film, asked me to help him produce it. And so I really found that collaborative process really charming and exciting and inspiring. And towards, you know, when I was sort of figuring out that I would actually getting promoted in my in the advertising agency kind of scared me, because it was really well. And I'm like, this is not what I want. Right. You know, I don't want to be the head of an advertising agency. I want to continue writing. So I had to make that choice. So it was very important for me to network, to get on writers groups, to take classes. I still take classes. You know, I love being a student to have that growth mindset, because I think you could always learn a trick or two when it comes to screenwriting. And there's always that process. And I think it just, if you focus on the craft, for me, it has definitely helped. And after a year of taking classes and workshops, I hired a coach, a career coach that helps emerging writers. So it's just sort of because I wasn't aware of how the industry really worked.
Sure.
Because I was coming sort of like from an outsider perspective, and I needed that to get that sort of advice and guidance. And a lot of those those tips are what a lot of people know. You know, constantly work on writing. You know, take notes nicely and kindly, and you know, continue working. And if you get stuck on one project, you know, move on to the next, build a portfolio. Right. All of that helped, but it was one specific script that really opened a lot of doors for me.
And was this Second Coming,
correct. Yeah. And it opened a lot of doors for me, got me my first manager, first representation. My career coach sent it to him and read it over the weekend. I got signed on a Monday. But a manager is not in the business of staffing you. It's the business of developing you. You're trying to set up projects and meet people. And so the way that I sort of, through actually taking another class, it was another class about building your application process for the writing fellowships. Mm-hmm. So it was David Perez, one of the writers on American Crime, that was teaching that class, because he had gone through that sort of path. And he got to read me, he got to know me. He really liked my background and my story. He sent my materials to ABC. Later I found out that it was, a week later I found out that it was the executive producers of American Crime. And they were looking for a staff writer. And they interviewed me. Then that went really well. And then John Reilly interviewed me. That went really well.
Yeah.
And some of the ABC executives interviewed me. That went really well. And ultimately, I got my first job on my own, essentially.
Yeah.
And that's when the agencies come in.
Right.
when you've done the work for them.
Once you've done all the work.
Your door.
there's a misconception. I mean, especially outside of Los Angeles, I think for folks who aspire to write, be a writer, or that, man, if you just get that manager and agent, you're set. But the reality is they can't do anything unless you have, to your point, built a portfolio and you're continuing to hone that craft. I think, some have said, and I think this is true, if you were to write 10 things and look back at those 10 things and say to yourself, wow, they're all really great, then you're actually really not progressing as a writer. Like, to your point, every script, every class, every experience gives you the opportunity to learn and evolve. And to that point, so you become a staff writer in American Crime. We're finding our way closely to present day, where we'll talk about the Netflix show. But then you land on Star. And so I guess the question for you is, what are the things that you didn't get to learn for yourself on American Crime, where you said, okay, when I go into this next experience, this is where I want to gain experience, this is what I want to do, become better at.
You know, there were such different experiences. American Crime, John, really, this is the third season. So it was, I mean, it was kind of a show that already knew what it was.
Right.
And John really was very efficient with the writing and making of American Crime. I mean, our room was 4 hours at most every day.
Wow.
And we really broke down that sort of 8 episode season relatively fast, because again, he would be very efficient with the room. He knew he had a vision, and he trusted the writers. You know, we came in with our pitches, prepared. It was about human trafficking, and so we pitched, you know, what we thought would be make compelling television. And you know, if he liked something, he would just, you know, put it on the board, and we moved on.
Right.
We rarely visited sort of that episode or that storyline or that moment. And to me, that's just, you know, because he's a pro. He's been doing it forever, Academy Award winner. So he was very kind of confident about what he wanted it. And also to give us a space to write and contribute. And that, I felt that was a very wonderful way to do it. But on Star, it's a different kind of beast, because there's a lot of storylines.
Right.
And it was, you know, 18 episodes. So we had to, you know, generate a lot of stories. So ultimately, I took the best of both worlds, because depending on the project is, you don't know, you know, where you're going to end up. If you're going to have to generate a lot of story and, you know, re-break episodes over and over because things are not working, or you get to have a sort of a vision that ends up working out like the first or second time you put it on paper, you right. know?
And what's the difference in style between someone like Ridley and Lee Daniels?
Well, you know, Lee Daniels wasn't in the room.
Right.
It was, the showrunner was Karen Gist, but it was, you know, it was broadcast. So I think the style, I think it's a little different, because it just, John really specifically knew what he wanted to put, and he already had sort of the idea of the storyline for how he wanted to treat the season for the human trafficking sort of element.
Right.
There's no specific crime. It was very nebulous, because human trafficking, you can't really pinpoint it. It's just the creativity of just exploitation and abuse.
Sure.
And for Star, we didn't know where it was going to go, because we're constantly like back and forth with the studio, with the network about some of the soapy elements. You know, we will lose actors, and we had to sort of re-break things. So it was a different, I feel like it was apples to oranges.
Sure.
When it came to the process, because it just demanded different things from the creative.
All right. So let's talk about Selena. So the first question that I have, and I want to know how you got involved and kind of the run up to writing and getting this thing ready to go. But I think the first question that any executive or creative person might ask if they're sitting opposite you or people pitching, you know, doing a series based on her story is, well, there was a movie in 97, Jennifer Lopez, you know, Gregory Nava. Why now? Why do we need a series now? And how is the story that we're telling in this series around her life different from what people have done before?
Well, I think Selena as a star and her legacy have constantly been underestimated as far as like the power that she still holds as a role model for a lot of Latinos in the U.S. and in Latin America.
Right.
I think that, you know, when I got involved, and I tell this story all the time, because you don't know what project leads to what project.
Sure.
And I had acquired, I already knew that in order to be a creator and a producer, you needed to sort of stop, you know, create your own opportunities. So
yes.
I had acquired the rights, the life rights to the world's youngest psychologist, who's this 13-year-old Mexican girl, a genius, kind of like a Mexican Doogie Howser.
Oh, wow.
And so I was trying to sort of soft pitch that around town, just, you know, in my general, so with buyers.
Right,
and so forth.
Right.
And it was going really well. And that was when my former agency at CAA, but like, you know, that might be actually, you know, if you're, you know, pitching that, that could also be good for Selena, you know, like it's sort of the tone and sort of what I was trying to do with that project.
Right.
And that's how I got involved. And I came in and I'm like, I grew up with Selena. I knew it was important. You know, her music is still playing. I mean, she's still, you know, her songs are still charting in the Billboard charts.
That's today. Crazy.
You know, top five, top 10, you know, she's not considered the most important Latina artist, according to Billboard. So, and also, you know, the legacy that she's left behind is there is this newer generation that just want Latina role models, Mexican-American role models, mm-hmm. and many of young women and young people are celebrate her, they look up to her. It's an American dream come true, especially for the, you know, US Latinos. And aside from, you know, Jennifer Lopez, who is of Puerto Rican descent, we really don't have a superstar of that caliber that is Mexican American that, you know, crossed over into the mainstream. And I think that's why her legacy still endures. And so when I came and pitched to the producers, I knew there was more than just what we had seen in the movie, because their life story, their family, you know, they started really young. They started, you know, she was a superstar 15 years in the making.
Right.
You know.
Well, didn't her father have his own band, and then as the kids came into the picture, he continued to tour with them as young kids.
Yeah, he was a former musician, and you know, he was a rather successful during his time. But, you know, he had a family. As soon as they had kids, he had to sort of kind of refocus and provide for his family, because
right.
the music life, you know, it's not the most glamorous music life for a family, especially if you have babies, you know. So, but when he, of course, discovered this incredible talent, this 9-year-old little girl singing, you know, Abraham himself shared a lot of those old recordings when Selena was young, and it was just incredible. She was so talented, and it was sort of another opportunity of that music dream. And now he could support, you know, this little girl's talent and provide a path for her to become, you know, who she became.
And so clearly the movie has a very, very distinct, it's a very distinct chapter of her life that ends in a very specific moment. For the series, this is not billed as a limited series, so I'm assuming that we're telling this story. If the audience shows up for it and Netflix feels like the algorithm is telling them positive things, that we're talking multiple seasons of telling this story of her ascension.
Well, yes, I for the most part, I have, well, with the exception that this is it is a limited series. It has been told as
okay.
a 2-part series. The first part, you know, premiering December 4th on Netflix.
So how many episodes total are we talking?
I'm not quite sure if I can tell you how many for the second part, but the first part is 9 episodes.
Okay. That's very good. Your media training is good. So, but by the time we're done telling this story, will it end in kind of the same place as where the movie ended? Most people who, I don't want to ruin it for people who don't know her story, so I don't want to kind of project out where that end is or what occurs. Where do we start? Is it her father as a musician? Does he already have the kids as a family?
We spend a lot of time in the early days.
Okay.
Especially, you know, there is a scene where we do see Selena, you know, sort of just being born and how she actually gets her name. That I found that, you know, one of the sweet things and charming things that Abraham and Marcella shared with us, the parents. And so we do spend some time in the early days. We do spend some time when she's a teenager and coming of age, and in sort of the earlier struggles of what it was to be on the road, and, you know, how basically she was, you know, doing high school through correspondence school. And then we do spend in the second part how she is coming into her own independence, and she's empowered as an artist and on her road to becoming a superstar, especially because she's doing things that no other artist at the time was doing, like creating sort of a fashion line, a perfume line, sort of this sort of 360 approach mm-hmm. to a brand, to an artist, you know. And we will go into the tragedy that happens in her life. And so this series is sort of a detailed look into the journey of the making of Selena Quintanilla. And the first part focuses a little bit more of a family ensemble, because it was important to tell that without her family, Selena wouldn't have been the superstar that she became to be.
Yeah. And so for you on this show, also as executive producer, what new muscles are you developing and flexing throughout the creation, the writing, and the production of this show?
Well, you know, one of the things that I actually have to like credit my my advertising career, you know, because I started as a translator, ended up becoming a copywriter, and then yeah. associate creative director, with the opportunity to pitch, you know, ideas to the buyers and kind of manage a creative team. Oversee production and deadlines, and those are kind of the things, the kind of the skills that you need to become a co-showrunner, to be at the point where you have to sort of manage a team of 14 writers, you know, and it's management.
Sure. Yeah.
Which a lot of my writers are not equipped to do. It was lucky enough that my job was allowed, you know, my previous experience was allowed me to sort of be able to handle that, and so. That I those muscles definitely exercised them some more, and I was very happy to as a first time showrunner was capable of doing. And you know, I think the new muscle is now you have a bunch of, I got like 18, 19, 20 or however scripts we went through of episodes. You know, we ended up cutting it down, but you're constantly rewriting. You're constantly revising. Sometimes not because the story is just not working, but because, you know, you have to merge scenes because of production issues or
sure.
the stuff that you usually, you know, a staff writer, I was able to get to do on my episode, you know, now as a showrunner, you got to do it times 20, times 10, you know, depending on where you're at.
Was it all shot before the pandemic?
We half shot.
Half
so
shot.
We did get interrupted. We were hoping to shoot the whole thing.
Got it.
We did get interrupted. And my contract ended, and we didn't know when we were going to get back to production, and we finished shooting this just, you know, recently. So because it picked up again in September, knowing, you know, with the protocols, the safety protocols,
right,
and finished the episodes. At that point, you know, it was the producers that carry on with the production without me. I still, you know, got the dailies and everything, but it was impossible to.
And so what do you, as this thing launches, so the first 9 episodes on Friday, December 4th, a great opportunity for people to binge them all at once. What are you hoping people take away from this? And I'd say this too, I'd caveat it. There's clearly a built-in audience, to your point. Her songs still chart. There's within, you know, the Mexican-American culture, there is an extreme awareness of who she is and her legacy. Is there a hope? Is there an assumption that this will bring new folks into the fold in a way that maybe previous things had not?
I mean that was the goal, because, you know, being on Netflix, it's this show is going to drop in 190 countries, you
yeah,
know,
that's great.
And you want to create a story that is universal, that has global appeal. And we always wanted to stay in that sort of space, you know, what is relatable for everyone. And I think that is, you know, working hard towards something that you're passionate about, the struggles, financial struggles, family issues, sort of all relatable universal themes of, you know, trying to achieve a dream. And once you achieve your dream, how do you sustain it? How do you keep it alive?
Sure.
You know, because I think there's so much emphasis on like, getting to that place that you always wanted to sort of experience, but then what happens when you're there? You know,
right.
How do you keep that fire going? How do you keep that alive? How do you, you know, what's the next step after that? And And that's something that all those universal themes that we wanted really to explore, because they're there and they experienced it. And so it's an inspirational, wholesome, you know, story for the whole family. I think kids will be able to see it, you know, 8-9 year olds, because I think it's important for this show to reach out all the generations. I think, you know, watch it together. Yeah. And because it is so inspiring despite of the tragedy, from humble beginnings to becoming a superstar. I mean, that I think has global appeal, and we know that the rack to riches sort of story brings people to watch. And in this case, it's a very unique perspective. It's a Mexican American family from South Texas that achieves the ultimate international dream.
No, it's a great story. And aside from all of the things that you just mentioned, I would assume for you, one of the most important things of it premiering is that once again, your parents will see your name on screen, which will just further justify
a bunch of times by executive producer.
That's right. That's right. you can't borrow any more money from your parents going forward. This is it.
No, now you're asking me for money. It's like payback.
There you go. There you go. They'll come to you. So let's talk about now the others. So talk to me about, so this is, and I kind of set it up at the beginning of this and the commentary episode. This is a movie, you know, 2001 release. I mean, the Nicole Kidman piece, clearly a big piece of the above the line budget of this movie, but at a $17 million budget, this goes off to do over $200 million. It is a genre film before, I think, even though, you know, the Blumhouse model was in full effect. I think also at an earlier part of the industry where directors, foreign language directors, came to the market with their first English language film. Talk to me about when you first saw it. What is it about this film that inspires you? Why you picked it?
You know, when I've always have, you know, and especially in college, I always have been fascinated by European cinema, you know, and one of the classes that I took at Brown was the making of Pedro Almodovar. And as a result, I just really studied a lot of the Spanish cinema that made Pedro Almodovar, or around the context of Pedro Almodovar. And one of those films that we studied in Deconstructor was Amenábar's Tesis, which I just was riveted by. Yeah. It was just so compelling because it was sort of an attempt at something very dark, you know, snuff films. And I just was fascinated with that kind of darkness and humanity. And in fact, a lot of foreign cinema for me, it was the introduction of just new forms and structures and multiple genres in one. And so that's when I was started to slowly be enamored with you know, the possibility of genre to tell a different, compelling, you know, character-driven story through you know, a typical trope, sort of, you know, haunted mansion, in which, you know, I speak about a lot in the commentary, and just seeing the layers that what you think might be sort of kind of easy movie to write, because everything feels so familiar, it really is layered and compelling, and it's making in construction. And I was already a fan of Amenábar, so I seen The Others and seen this English language attempt. It just kind of made my worlds collide, being bilingual and experiencing his sort of, you know, films, very Spanish specific. From Spain and the sort of that language and that culture, and just making that jump and having that ability to make that jump into something completely different and in English, and takes place in England. And so that sort of kind of opened my world, sort of that kind of reassured on a personal level that I too could explore both of those identities for myself and succeed at it. And I think that was very inspiring.
And in addition to that, are there particular, and I don't want to, you, clearly you go into it in the commentary, but are there particular things that he does in the film, whether it be more practical versus you know, the writing or character arcs, but are there any particular things when you see them in the film that you say to yourself, man, I would love to be able to do something like that in one of my projects?
I think there were two things that really, as a director, you know, if I ever take on that sort of task, it's very intimidating for me to even take, you know, because I think there's a lot more technicality that I'm not aware of. And right. when I see directors, you know, on television, you know, on the TV set and I've experienced, it's just a magic that sometimes, you know, they're seeing something that I'm not seeing. And one of it is just working with a cinematographer and to be able to use light as a form of telling a story. Sort of the darkness that we experience in the others is sort of like the safe space, something that we are, you know, where we live with the family. And then when the lightness come in, it's the danger. Right. And seeing Nicole Kidman come from darkness to lightness and sort of that very specific way of directing her. And, you know, we see her hysterics, her fear, her terror when she's surrounded by sunlight.
Right.
You know, and it just sort of subverting that norm to me was just one of those technicalities and a specific sort of decisions and choices that I think, you know, simple, seemingly, but very complex when it comes to pulling it off. And I thought that, you know, to me that it's all about creating that ambience that made this film successful in directing.
Were you aware that they're planning a remake of this movie?
I am. I read that. And of course, my I went through that sort of, you know, I think it was just like the stages of grief.
Right. Yeah.
I was angry, in denial.
Right. I mean, it's, do we need it? I mean, that's always the interesting question. I mean, here you are. I mean, you're telling Selena's story in it for a new audience, for a new time, in a new way. That I think is different, telling the story of a real person and a journey for a different audience is different than going off and trying to remake a movie like the others. I mean, it's hopefully it doesn't come to pass, because it is almost a perfect movie in the sense what Alejandro did with it. So
yeah, I think I think it's going to be impossible to beat, and I think it is going to be very difficult to compare it with this possible new version. And I see the concept behind possibly redoing it again, given, like, you know, the pandemic and sort of the claustrophobic or the lockdown. And so I do see having this sort of, you know, taking the concept, at least the premise, and just sort of like going and running with it and making it, you know, sort of a contemporary. So I think it'll be, you know, ironically, yes, complaining about a remake, and yet here I am telling you a remake of Selena.
Yours is different, though. Yours is different.
Yours is different. Yours is different. That's right. What we got. But I think it's, after my process of grieving, I came to acceptance, which, you know, I'm now looking forward to see what they do with it. Yeah. I think it'd be a really interesting project on its own. And I think it won't steal from the others, because I think the others is just, like you said, almost a perfect movie. And it's just, I think it's going to have its own little, you know, opportunity to shine through.
Well, it's, you know, it's, I know people who refuse to watch black and white movies for the idiotic mentality of, oh, it's an old movie. Like I have, you know, two young daughters who are, you know, in junior high school, who the first thing they ask is, when is that movie from? It doesn't matter how it looks. Oh, it was from the 90s. I don't want to watch that movie. So there is clearly an audience for things that are made now, despite the fact that they may be inspired by a story that was already told. So, well, the others, you know, for people that haven't seen it, it's available on all digital platforms. The commentary is a great listen, so it's a great opportunity, especially here we are. Of course, after, either before December 4th, when the new show comes out, watch it, or you can binge the 9 episodes and then watch the others with Moises' commentary after. But I want to thank you for A, taking the time to do the commentary for the others, and B, taking the time to sit down and talk about how you got to this point in your career, the show, and recommend that everybody check it out when it comes out on Netflix in 190 countries on December 4th. Moises, thank you so much for taking the time.
Thank you, Paul. It was a great experience. I love the others, and I hope that even the people that haven't seen it get to enjoy it as well.
Awesome. Thanks. And so there you have it. Moises Zamora, creator, co-creator, co-showrunner, and writer of Netflix's Selena, the series. Coming out on December 4th for your binging pleasure. Want to thank him for joining us, as I said previously, and recommend that if you haven't seen the others or it's time to watch it again, you can navigate towards our next episode, which is the commentary of Moises Zamora watching the others. You're on the sidetrack. As always, this is Paul Davidson saying thanks for joining us. The 3 R's of podcasting: rate, review, and retweet. Please take that to heart. And that's what we got for this week. So thank you very much, and we'll see you next week with yet another episode of The Sidetrack.